Good morning, everybody. Hello. Thank you very much, Iris and Elena, for inviting me to assess this excellent work on Sudan and South Sudan. I'm very pleased to be asked. I learned a great deal from this book, as well as how useful this book is going to be for future research in the Sudan. But let me first talk to say this new book in the new series of Leave a Mam is a series of academic book presentation organized by the IREMAM, IREMAM Research Institute on the Arab and Islamic World at Aix-Marseille, University of Aix-en-Provence, France. My name is Ahmed Eshahi. I'm a member of the Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, Oxford University, and founding member of the Sudanese program in the UK since 2002. I'm a social anthropologist by training, but I'm also a believer into the importance of history in interpreting social institutions and vice versa. The book, which is the subject matter of this of this Zoom meeting webinar, is Ordinary Sudanese between 1504 and 2019, from social history to politics from below, includes two volumes and 22 chapters. It has been co-edited by Elena Bazzadini and Iris Sherry Hirsch, Lucy Revelle, Anail Posier, and Mahasin Abdel Jalil. The contributors are historian, anthropologists, and political scientists from Sudan, South Sudan, France, and the UK, Italy, Germany, and US and Japan. The book covers a wide range of topics, including archival issues, women agency, the armed forces, colonial history, labor practices, and Sudanese politics. It was written during and after the Sudanese so-called December Revolution that toppled President Omar Hassan al-Bashir in April 2019. Here with us today are Elena Bazzadini and Iris Sherry Hirsch. Now, let me talk about the background of our colleagues. Hello, Elena. Elena Bazzadini is a research fellow in modern history at the French National Center for Scientific Research. She is the director of the African Worlds Institute in Paris. Her research has focused on the history and memory of early Sudanese nationalism, trade unionism, women and the press, and the expression of emotions in colonial and early post-colonial Sudan. She is currently developing a comparative history of female urban professions in the 20th century Sudan, Tanzania, Ghana, in the framework of an ERC research project. I turn now to Iris. Iris is an associate professor in modern Middle Eastern studies at Aix-Marseille University and a member of IREMAM. Her research has explored Sudanese-Ethiopian relations during the Mahdiya, as well as the nexus between education, citizenship, and violence in colonial and post-colonial Sudan. She has studied literacy issues, history teaching, moral education, politics of Arabization and Islamization, and military instruction in Sudanese schools. Her current project analyzes how Eastern Mediterranean marshes inhabited by water buffalo herders were transformed into a Palestinian-Israeli locality between the late Ottoman era and the 1960s. So now we turn to, I have read this book, which I enjoyed enormously, and I learned a great deal, and I have pose some question to supplementary asking for supplementary question. And both Elena as well as Iris have selected 9 questions which are pertinent to the book itself. And I'm very glad that they chose the very thing which I thought perhaps very important for the audience and discussions to answer these questions. So I turn now to Iris and Elena to answer some of these questions. I am here to answer, to add, or to think. So I leave that to you, Iris and Elena.
So you have been very kind to, you know, prompt us to answer to the question, what is ordinary?
Yes.
Because, you know, in a title like Ordinary Sudan, it is really fundamental. What do we mean by ordinary? What is the sense of that, especially considering the fact that we cover a period of history which is extremely long, from the Funj time to the 2019 events, and that we cover categories of people that are totally different. We have soldiers and policemen, cinema goers, alcohol drinkers, midwives, women activists, rural workers, city dwellers. So how do we put all these people in one category that we call ordinary? But we try to, in fact, maintain in the introduction of the book that this category, ordinary, has what I call a heuristic value, is still interesting. In fact, for us, it indicates a relation of power and it implies a politics of representation. So ordinary people are those seen as such by those who govern, and they are viewed as people undeserving as a special gaze, for whatever reason they may be. Maybe because they belong to a sexual or an ethnic minority, because, like the police, they belong to the banal executors of the violence of the state, or because as women, they're seen as passive actors, in fact, and not as agent of history. So to sum up, the term ordinary expresses a relationship and a way to look at people from the part of those who have power that has a clear archive effect, because we do have a great difficulties of finding traces of those actors, and therefore the writing of history about them is very, very different. Mm. And I just say that this is really the theme. This theme has been tackled by the article by Mohsin Abdeljalil on tarnished history versus celebrated narratives. And she maintains exactly that there are a variety of narratives that in several ways have been obliterated, either because the events have not been recorded in archives, they are not made it into archival traces, or because, in fact, traces are eliminated into the archive, or because historians, because of social pressure, gives in fact, to social norms and consider certain topics as unspeakable. For example, the question of sexual minorities or slavery or sexuality and so on. So for us, it is clear that being ordinary doesn't mean to be normal, but is rather what histories has tended to forget because it's not worth representing. So thank you very much for this question that really allows us to answer to a very fundamental question in the book.
This particular question leads to something. If you talk about ordinary Sudanese, perhaps future research will have what they call mass archives. And mass archives means you go with your microphone around in the streets, in the villages and things, and ask people what they think. So you have a kind of representation from the ordinary people, whether in Khartoum or outside, and their reflection on events, and becomes what they call oral history. It becomes a very important part of future written history of events in the Sudan. Well, thank you. The second question, which I think it is the question of the use of the word revolution. Is it appropriate to use it? Is like, and I think I have said that revolution, what, like French Revolution, like the Ottoman Revolution, like the Persian Revolution, and you got all these revolution who turned the structure of society upside down. In Sudan, still the power is still the same in situ. The army had, you know, they had no change. All the institution, the judiciary, the educational system is still the same. And I have said this to Sudanese, that the best, from my point of view, is to say, talk about an uprising. Yes, within the element of uprising, you're trying to change, but unfortunately, the army has been in power more or less since, not 1958, but certainly 1969. So it's a continuous, how many years the army have, no change structurally. So I leave it to you. You tell me what you think.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that question. I think it raises the important issue of analytical categories versus ordinary representation of the social world. In other words, can or should the 2019 events in Sudan called a revolution? So I think both categories are significant here, and I will a little bit elaborate on that. So maybe let's first recall the political context in which this book was produced. In fact, it started as an international conference that was held in Paris in December 2019, which means that it was just 8 months after the demise of President Omar al-Bashir and just 3 months after the setting up of a so-called transitional government under a civilian prime minister. We recall here economist Abdullah Hamdok. And at that time, some parliamentary elections were planned for 2022. So we have to recall that the authors wrote their papers in the euphoric and uncertain times of a kind of revolution in the making. So that was an important point. And it was such an uncertain configuration that it has also a strong impact on the production of knowledge in Sudan and on Sudan. So I will just raise 2 points here. First, there was a sense of urgency to collect testimonies and preserve rare materials. So we could see also at that period new archival initiatives on the latest revolutionary sequence, but also on Sudanese history more broadly. I'm thinking here about the Sudan Memory Project, which is an online project, but also on archival projects about trade unions and the women's movements. And the second point is that, of course, the transformation of Sudan's political landscape has affected the ways in which we as scholars reflect on our research topics. Of course, there are also variations according to individual sensibilities and so on. But for example, for historians, I think that there is a need to avoid projecting the present onto the past, but at the same time, we have paid closer attention to revolutionary moments and movements both across time, so for example in Sudan in the 19th and 20th centuries, and place. So we also have considered Sudan as part of the Arabic-speaking world, hence locating the 2019 uprising in the context of the so-called Arab Springs from Tunisia and Egypt in 2011 up to Algeria, Lebanon and Iraq in 2019. So let's move now. Let's move on to the IMIC categories, or the categories used by the Sudanese demonstrators and activists themselves. Maybe we should just recall two slogans that were used in 2019. One was "Huriya Salam wa Adala, Al-Thawra Khiyar Al-Shab," namely "Freedom, Peace, and Justice. The Revolution is the People's Choice." Or there was another slogan, Sulta Madaniya au Thawra Abadiya, namely civil rule or everlasting revolution. So there certainly was a popular claim of initiating and experimenting a revolution, which I think should be taken seriously, even if the mass mobilization was followed by many disillusions, of course. So the last point is also about the results or the ensuing developments after al-Bashir's downfall, which you have already began to trace. So I think on the one hand, we could observe a more freedom of thought, of expression, some changes in public behaviors in the public space. This could be seen in the press, but also in the educational field with some reforms, for example, in the history curriculum, which led to some controversies. In the opening of art galleries, music concerts, mainly in cities such as Khartoum and Omdurman. But on the other hand, of course, as months passed, the limitations of the 2019 uprising, or what might be termed a counter-revolution, became increasingly clear. There was this power-sharing agreement between civilians and the military, but then there was this coup d'etat by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan in October 2021, and the ensuing arrestation and resignation of Prime Minister Hamdok at the beginning of 2022. So yeah, we witnessed the fact that the Sudanese military took control of the entire state apparatus, yet popular demonstrations and strikes continued and were harshly repressed. So I will just add to this that the book manuscript was finalized before the outbreak of a new episode of armed conflict in April 2023.
Right.
That is the power struggle, you know, between the National Army led by al-Burhan and the Rapid Support Forces led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. And maybe Elena has also something to add to this issue, to this question.
Thank you. There's one thing: the Sudanese army prior to al-Bashir, it was very much respected and as an institution. Mm-hmm. And it was casted as the army will protect the boundaries of Sudan. That was the image of it, you know. So it was really an important initiative. Now is reviled on both. It's extraordinary change, mm-hmm. because the army turned against civilians on both sides, killing civilians. Rather, mm-hmm. you know, why? They say, why do you kill us? We haven't, you know, gone, you know. So there is a shift in terms of image and reality that the army is not behaving how the ordinary Sudanese perceive the army to be as an institution of protecting the people. And secondly, I think is in relation to this, why I'm, you know, put this question is that whatever research is doing, it tend to be an urban concentrated perception of an institution. I mean, how much, for example, in Kutum, in Kosti, in Karma, or something, how people, Sudanese, perceive this themselves, you know, tend to see just urban orientated explanation of the political process. But perhaps this may come again later on. Let's move on to the third question, which is important and is coming back to both of you, Elena and Arisina, what is the purpose of doing this book? You know, when I said is the purpose of editing such an interesting volume?
Yeah, thank you for this question, which is very broad. So I will try not to be too long, but there are many elements here. I will start by recalling the six major parts of the book.
Yeah.
Because I think we haven't discussed this yet. So the two volumes have six parts. And so the first one tackles the entanglement between archives, social history and power. Yeah. The second focuses on women's agency in history and politics from the Funj era to the recent 2019 revolution or uprising. Part three includes contribution on the history and global connections of the Sudanese armed forces. And then the next part, the part four, intersects the themes of urban life, leisure, and colonial attitudes with queerness.
Yeah.
Then we have a part on labor identities, practices, and institutions, which are discussed in urban milieus, but also against the background of war and expropriation in rural areas, and especially in the Nuba Mountains.
Right.
And then the last part studies the construction of social consent under various self-styled Islamic regimes, such as the Mahdiya and in the Ingaz regime, as well as the emergence of alternative imaginaries and acts of citizenship in times of political openness. So I should say that the South Sudan is underrepresented in the book, and that it's not a scientific choice on our part. It rather reflects the academic composition of people that actually responded to the call for papers and then contributed to the book. So we would like to have more contributions on South Sudan, but I think it's also linked to our, you know, scientific networks. But it's not like something that is really a purpose here. So maybe let me try to trace the contribution of this book to the field of Sudan studies. We should maybe recall the historical origin of the word Sudan, especially for people that are not familiar with Sudan studies. Let us recall that it comes from the Arabic expression Bilad al-Sudan, land of the blacks, which was coined by medieval Arab geographers to refer to a very broad and loosely defined area stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to the Red Sea. And that the word Sudan was later used by Egyptian and European colonizers in 19th century Africa. So we can speak here about the territories conquered by Ottoman Egypt from 1820. And then in 1899, the country was renamed the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan because of this special dual colonial type of rule. What is interesting here is that this initially external exogenous term was reappropriated by the country's inhabitants, but its meanings have varied according to different contexts. So if we take, for example, the Sudani adjective, we see that it served to refer to slave people from southern Sudan and Darfur until the 1920s, at least, and that later it came to be used to refer to members of a Sudanese nation conceived as distinct from Egypt. So it took on like a political meaning. And then if we take Sudan as a place name, of course, it was the name of a huge country from 1956 till 2011, from Wadi Halfa near Egypt up to the Ugandan border. And after the secession of South Sudan, only the north kind of remained Sudan. Now, Sudan studies as a research field has its own history and particular position. It is located at the crossroads or on the margins of Middle Eastern and African studies because of Sudan's geographical location, linguistic and religious diversity, and also the academic specialization of Sudan scholars. And we should note that there are still quite few Sudan specialists, especially compared to other fields of research, for example, about Egypt. So I think that this quite rarity is linked to this in-between geographical and cultural position. We see that Sudan is often absent from works on the Islamic or the Arab world. It's not always included in Africanist studies also. It's also linked to its singular status as an Anglo-Egyptian condominium in colonial times, so that Sudan is also often excluded from works on the British Empire. It's also linked to the long, very long civil wars that have plagued the country since independence. And I think it may be linked to Sudan's marginalization in international diplomatic circles in the 1990s because of the al-Bashir's support for the Al-Qaeda jihadist organization then. So this book is first and foremost a new collective and multidisciplinary contribution to a field that requires more visibility at the international level. Even 40 years after the creation of the Sudan Studies Association in the US and the Society for the Study of the Sudans in the United Kingdom. Of course, a number of important volumes and journal issues have been published, mostly in the fields of political science, geography, and anthropology. Yet, collective research projects and publications on the history of the Sudans, and especially on social history, are very rare.
Very rare.
So the book aims, you know, to share the results of recent research, stressing the role of ordinary men and women in Sudanese societies and politics. So there is this political aspect of showing how people played a key role, you know, in political upheavals, but also how they contributed to the making and maintenance of authoritarian regimes, such as the Ingaz regime, for example. But the purpose was also to explore Sudanese daily life from various perspectives, at school, at work, in the army, through health issues, conceptions of holiness, gender relations, leisure activities, for example, alcohol, cinema, sexualities, and neighborhoods, using historical and anthropological methods. And here we have to say that we made a choice of crisscrossing disciplines around specific themes, rather than organize the book along chronological lines or geographical focus. And maybe a last point about our position as scientific editors in a broader context of glaring inequalities that still characterize the global economy of knowledge. We know that most academic institutions, funding, scholars, publication, are still concentrated in the global north. And in this case, we have benefited from financial support by French institutions. Mm-hmm. But one important aim was to provide an international forum for Sudanese scholars who usually write and teach in Arabic. So we have several chapters that were written in Arabic and then translated into English. The book also seeks to enrich scientific conversations among Sudan scholars from different academic traditions. And also there are a few chapters that we can say that lie at the intersection between standard academic writing, at least according to international norms, and politically or socially engaged texts. And here I speak about authors who are actors or have been previous actors of the situations they analyze. So they provide interesting insiders' perspectives. For example, the chapter by Ammar Mohamed El-Bagir on the history of the police, and the chapter by Safa Mohamed Khair on female activists. Mm-hmm. So in sum, this volume tries to react to some of the most salient or striking features of Sudan studies, connecting Sudan to some larger global trends, because Sudan has often been presented as being sort of one in a kind. So yeah, it has peculiarities, but it should also be connected to wider trends. I should mention here the examples of the chapters of by Heather Sharkey and Massimo Zaccaria, who follow Sudanese soldiers across Northeast Africa and as far as Mexico, where they took part in a French invasion in the 1860s. The book also reacts to the what we can call the Arabization paradigm, which has tended to dominate scholarly interpretations of Sudan's long-term history. So here we wanted to foster research on the early modern era. We wanted to foster research on the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries before the colonial conquests. And we have to say that initially, quite a few papers on the Funj era were presented at the Paris conference, especially on the social position and legal practices of women in the Sultanate of Sinnar, who were studied through court records, awqaf, and travelers' accounts. But unfortunately, these papers did not make it into the published volume. So we have only one chapter by Amel Osman on women in the Fung era. And lastly, I think this book also reacts to a kind of deterministic vision of the country's recent history. I try to explain this point. The present has sometimes been framed only in terms of violence and failure and projected onto the past, so that a complex history has been transformed into a kind of theology of disaster. So here we try to pay attention to specific actors, institutions, and contexts in order to re-inject some historical contingencies into the scholarly readings of the Sudanese past, I should say. Yeah.
Good. Thank you very much, Iris, for elaborating on the question of the purpose of editing such diverse book. Now we move on to the fourth question, is the perception of women, feminism, in Sudan, as well as by non-Sudanese way of looking at a male-female relationship in Sudan and Sudan in institution. I don't know what my feeling is that from a Sudanese perspective, this is how I see it myself, educated Sudanese women tend to look down at their sisters in the countryside, thinking that, oh, they haven't got BA, they haven't got MA, they haven't got PhD. That is totally wrong. Education enlarges your knowledge, yes, but you have to listen to these women to see how they perceive their life. You know, what contribution. I just want to give you an example which never been mentioned in the book. I dealt in 1968 with the 1968 election in the North. And it came to my knowledge, and I was there watching the voting, you know, one day for men, one day for women. And if you count the votes of women and put it on every single candidate, whether it's a Muslim brother or Khatmis or Ummah or communist, even there was a socialist one, they will win because women are in a majority. And this is why some of the educated Sudanese men do not like, you know, women to be part of it. I mean, you say about, you know, the organization of women in Sudan and, you know, they are fighting for their women rights into the state, but really they don't go and look and sit with a Bija woman, with Ababda woman, right, or with somewhere in the, you know, Kordofan woman in the countryside to see, what do you think about yourself, what do you think, you have so many children, what about education? They don't. They sit in their offices in Khartoum and pontificate about the woman. That is a fundamental error in the way Sudanese women educate, think they know better. No, they don't know better because they don't know the others, what the others think. They dismiss it as if no consequence. So I leave this to you to see whoever want to answer this. Is it Elena, you want to meant to do that?
Hello, yes, this is for me because I follow closely this part on gender.
Yes.
So I prepared an answer. So again, I think that the answer is historiographical in the sense that we started from the feeling that there is a real problem with the history of women in Sudan because it is characterized by lack, especially in English. Of course, works in Arabic are more present, but still, at least in English, there is a sore absence of works about the history of women. And of course, when we talk about the history of women, immediately you see the problem of this category because there is not one, but many. And really the book, it is exactly what it shows. It really gives glimpses of the history of the Fung, women under the Fung, And then it follows up midwives in the Nuba Mountains. And then again, you have something about the Islamic movement and women. And then again, something about the Sudanese Women Union. Again, we have the problem of putting in the same categories all this, which is problematic. But in on the other hand, it says if we don't start from somewhere, we will not manage to go forward. So this was the contribution which we got, and which we very glad to have, because they of course complexifies the whole question. As to this rural-urban divide, we have given a careful thoughts about that. First, just to mention that we, in this diversity, we have at least this chapter about midwives that covers in details the lives, experience, education, and history of midwives. Also, the creativity and endurance in relation to a situation of total deprivation and need where they didn't even have tools to make operation, and they have to be super creative in finding ways in which they could save lives, just to see themselves discredited by the following generation of certified midwives because they were untrained. This is probably the only case in point that really focus on rural areas. On the other hand, we have this article on the Funj, on the history of women in the Funj. And what we also, as from the historian point of view, we find it interesting is that even though you have a very mainstream sources, of course, the Tabakat of Wad Ifalla is like the basics for writing the history of the Funj, even there, by deconstructing this source, in between the lines, you can have information about the history and the agency of women at that time, which, of course, I mean, is just a step. There are many other things that we could say and we could write, but it is important because it is there. Then I am the author of this article about the press, and I'm happy for this question because it gives me the occasion of saying something that which is not in the article, which is even though we consider that the press is something very much connected to alphabetization and to elite, which I should have perhaps underlined better, is that in the 50s, the press was like the radio or the television nowadays. And the person that will read in the city or in the village will read the article aloud to the rest of the audience. So even if there is one person that is able to read, then a lot of other people will benefit from that. And this press was totally indispensable in places where people needed information about what happened elsewhere. This is why you will find copies in the of newspaper in all like commercial points of cities of the size of Bara, Nuhud, or Kosti, and so on and so forth, even which are still urban center, but middle size or even smaller size, because people really relied on the press to get information from what happened somewhere else. So the women, the first women journalists, were very careful in trying to seize the press as a platform to spread their ideas, even though they couldn't control whether people would read or not their own articles. It was the only way they had to, you know, to go beyond the small circle of the people that wrote those articles and the small elite of women that were able to write. So there was a technique. So it is a good idea for me for the next for the future to underline this aspect as the means by these people to try to reach out their elite or the place from where they were based. And then it is true that the article by Abir Noor on the Sudanese General Union Movement, or the article by Safa Mohamed Kher on the Sudanese Women Union and you know women activists throughout the century, they are kind of based on movements that are in cities. But still, I think that some of the conclusion, they can be applied also to groups of people that are generally Sudanese, or to you know, general conclusion that are not only related to the group that produced those ideology. The fact, for example, that Abir showed the way in which the Islamist ideology was not only an ideology out there, but was very much connected to clientelism and patronage that managed to make this ideology rooted among Sudanese women. And then the same for Safa. For us, it was a very important contribution because of the scarcity of works in English, and also her position as a person that was first a PhD student at the University of Khartoum in history, but herself very connected to this world of activism. So it was still a contribution that was for us as having an insider point of view, but still giving glimpses about history, which in the scarcity of works on Sudanese women was very important for us. So for us, it's to make a too sharp division between educated and uneducated is complicated because of these elements. It is true that in relation to what you said, we didn't really focus on the way in which educated women made it or tried to make it to reach out. I have sources about that. I know that, for example, in the 50s and the 60s, the women of the Sudanese Union, they were very much interested in reaching out. They were trying through the press. And in the press, in a journal like Saut al-Mara, you see articles, for example, about the Bijo women or Hadendoa or Bagara. They wrote articles about them, you know, to celebrate the diversity of Sudan. So they were trying to advertise the beauty of this diversity, and through the press they were hoping to reach out. But it is true that it's not something that we have been focusing on the book, and this is something that we can, I hope, in the future some scholarship can take up.
Thank you very much. I pose this question for two things, is that literacy and perception. You know, the educated Sudanese woman tend to link these things when you say, well, it doesn't matter if you don't read, you know, if you haven't done your degrees or you haven't read books, you have a perception, you are a person, you think about your circumstances, about your life, about your husband, about your children, about your future. And these, that kind of information is being put aside by educated women because it doesn't count as far as they are concerned. They don't go and consult and sit with a Bija woman or a Bagara woman or a Kababish and say, your sister, what do you think about, you know, you spend so much of your time trying to help men, trying to help the economy. What do you think? How could the state help you? How could we help you as educated women? There is that. I was there, 2 years living in the north? I haven't seen a single Sudanese educated woman coming from the city and sitting with these women or talking to these women. Not at all. They are sitting in Khartoum, and I say pontificate, unfortunately, you know, pontificate about the future and about how they should improve situation of women without knowing what it is needed in the countryside. And I think that's a major problem. I hope that from now onwards or in the future, you know, these educated Sudanese will wake up to the fact that degrees does not make you a good person.
Exactly.
It will give you knowledge, but it gives you some knowledge, sorry, but it doesn't make you better than any other woman.
I can just quickly react, as especially of the 50s, of course, that the Sudanese Women Union in the 50s had, I mean, major structural constraint, of course. Women in the 50s, they had problem to go out in the street without being, you know, accompanied by a man. So, and they had no money, of course. But again, I mean, they themselves, they relate a very, very difficult situation. This is why they are called the pioneers, because they were the first.
Yes, absolutely.
To go out and speak in public. But then I will stay there and
thank you.
To the next question.
Yeah, and linking up is a question of why Sudanese, again, it's related to what we have been discussing, that why do women join the Communist Party? For what reason? I mean, even men, they talk, even the Communist Party in Sudan itself, and you say, you're talking about communism, Marxism, Engels, and so forth, so on. Well, can you tell me are they multimillionaire or multi-billionaire, or are they, you know, swath of, you know, land in northern Sudan or central Sudan owned by one particular person? Is this sort of bringing an ideology without knowing, does it make sense in the reality of the economic situation? In the north, the whole thing from Halfa right up to Khartoum, you know, it's just a tiny little strip of land full of dates. And this is shared by generations of Sudanese because of Sharia law of inheritance. So there is no idea of concentration of wealth in particular. Maybe in concentration of wealth in Khartoum, but not in the whole. You know, I mean, you look at the cattle of the Dinka. It's all shared. It's extraordinarily complex situation. Or, you know, or Kababish, people have shares into animals. Even in the north, people have share in one particular date farm. So when the harvest comes, all the dates collected, it has to be shared according to the Sharia law. So there is no chance for any kind of aristocracy, as some of them said, or, you know, join, oh goodness, if I join the Communist Party and it succeed in election, I would be better off. You know, I tell the communists, I say, just tell me who is in the countryside in Sudan, you know, who needs to join the Communist Party or what? So yeah, I don't know who is going to comment.
Very quickly, I will take this as well, because of course, again, I think we can place it from a historical point of view, in the sense that when it developed first in the 50s, 40s, it was also very strongly anti-colonial and anti-establishment, anti-colonial established movement. I think that you have heard many times the saying that Sudanese are natural communists, which goes a little bit in the sense of what you say. In the rural areas, of course, this what you say, it is probably true. I work, as you know, probably mostly in urban center, and there, communists, of course, you can take it as an ideology of Etani intelligentsia, but not only, as you know, it was also the ideology of neighborhood like Daim, and of course of cities like Atbara, which was connected to group of people that were on the one hand connected to the colonial state, part of the colonial state, because they were hired as workers, or later, even after the colonial state, they still kept working for the railways and so on and so forth for a state. But at the same time, they were very critical because, I mean, they experienced a lot of material constraint and hierarchy and injustice connected to this situation. So I think that in the urban center, it is not only an ideology of an elite, but is an ideology of working classes, where the working classes are present. And I stop here.
Thank you. Is perhaps one asks oneself, say, this migration of northern Sudanese, central Sudanese, west to the Gulf and to even to Europe as well, the land cannot accommodate them. Agricultural land is very small, and therefore larger population, they have to leave. There is, I mean, they are encouraged, saying, look, you know, you better go and find a work and earn some money to better yourself as well as better us, send us money. So this, the idea that there is a wealth concentrated in a particular a group of people in the north, it doesn't exist because they all share, they are all part of the kinship system, part of the tribal, and the Sharia law prevents such a concentration. The Sharia law of division of inheritance prevent such concentration of wealth in the hands of some people. So this is interesting thing. Let us go to move about the economic, political, and social legacies of the Anglo-Egyptian colonialism in Sudan. And that is very interesting. I have written an article at the conference, which was published, perhaps Iris would know, the Maghreb Review. You come across it?
Yeah, I noticed it, but unfortunately, I didn't have access to the whole article, but I saw the abstract only for the time being.
So yeah. I wrote an article on a comparison between the Turco-Egyptian colonial legacy in the Sudan and the Anglo-Egyptian legacy in Sudan, you know, what sort of thing. And this was something which has to be said, that the Sudanese didn't say Turkiye Lula, well, this was very bad. They are interested in just only collecting taxes, and they were very brutal in collecting such taxes. Whereas after the collapse of the Mahdist and left the devastation in the whole country, so the British, what they have to, it's such a vast country, the British have to start from scratch. Sudan didn't have any money at all. For the first 20, 30 years, even the Jazeera scheme was built by the British, not by Sudanese money. The Kitchener School of Medicine was by donation from ordinary English. People tend to look at colonialism, I'm not talking you or my Sudanese, dismissing it as all colonial, all exploitation. You say, well, you know, you have to give a credit to people who helped you, who established. Look at the University of Khartoum, who built it? Not Sudanese taxpayers, but the British, they have to, because they are responsible for creating roads, for creating institutions, civil service, railway, you know, it's everything. And then they dismiss it. Oh, this is all colonialism and things. And the article was written in that spirit, that one has to be just in terms of contribution. So I know, do you have any legacies of the Anglo-Egyptian colonialism in Sudan? Any reflection on this very briefly?
So again, this is divided the question. This is on me. In fact, again, is a thought-provoking discussion for us. Again, in the book, we take the pluralism as a starting point, in the sense that it is difficult to talk about one legacy, but a variety of legacies, and we try to take them from the point of view again of ordinary people. For example, I enjoyed a lot the article of Marina De Rico, in which she talks about Khartoum and Omdurman. Yeah. And she explains about, on the one hand, the British master plan and this tentative to rationalize Khartoum, and the fact that they really didn't manage when they tried in Omdurman, just barely some part of it. And then, in fact, the construction of the city followed a kind of a historical, as she say, traditional or would say spontaneous lines, in when people came, they settled down and the density became higher and higher. Mm. And the thing that I really enjoyed is when she analyzed the fact when the newcomer came, they settled together with people that they didn't necessarily knew, so that neighborhood were ethnically very, very varied, with background of people very different. And then, in fact, they had this nafaj system, that opening rear doors so that you could pass entire neighborhood from one house to the other without ever going to the street, in fact, outside. We show, in fact, the interconnection that was very often ethnic lines. So this description is very interesting because it's something that you still continue to have today, and that the regime of Bashir tried to, in a way, discourage, but still people have in some of the old part of Omdurman. Mm-hmm. So it is this was an interesting part. And then we have the chapter by Willow Berridge and Ahmed Sikaingi. Both of them are very interesting because they show clearly some legacies. In the case of Ahmed Sikaingi, the question of alcohol, the way in which the British sanctioned some type of alcohol and allowed others, in relation to what was dangerous or appropriate or not appropriate to Sudanese population, Sudanese men, of course. Okay. And this attempt to control and shape the consumption of alcohol is something that you can, of course, find again in the regime of Bashir. They tried, as Bashir tried, but I think that this attempt were very complicated to really carry on. And then Willow Berridge also with what she calls the colonial homophobia. In fact, the fact that you have this paradox of British colonial being very adverse to sexual practices, homoerotic sexual practices, and the fact that they never really issued any legislation completely, you know, or blatantly against homosexuality. But at the same time, in fact, they were very interconnected, this accusation of homosexuality, pro-Egyptian nationalist accusing British to be homosexual, and British accusing Egyptian of having brought homosexuality in Sudan, in fact, and to corrupt the Sudanese. And so, in fact, these discourses are really mutually constitutive. They were kind of mirroring the one to the other. And this fact of accusing homosexuality to the other, to the enemies, is something that you will find also later and again under the Bashin regime. And I would conclude with a Harry Cross article about banks. And for me, it's very interesting because you see this British bank, Barclays, coming to Sudan with this, I would say, aristocracy of employees. Employees aristocracy would have fantastic salaries. And then, even then, in 1964, they start to create trade unions and they start to ask for higher salaries and so on and so forth. So even so, you have an institution that will really be very closely connected to imperialism and to the colonial rule, then even that, at the end, in fact, it changes and bites back in a way the one that created it. So if we want to make a final point or conclusive point, it is, for us, it has been a pleasure to see all these different ways of relating to colonialism, which are not by way anyway monolithic. The only thing that we want to underline is our take on the issue, which is again try to be close to the actor, in the sense that we are not talking about colonial institution, colonial administration, colonial government and their legacies, but we try to put ourselves at the level of the citizen, men and women, and to see how they experience these legacies. And now in their life, they're seeing them sometime coming back at the time of Bashir. So in fact, we try to propose a new approach of colonial history, which is a kind of social history in the colonial time. And I will stop here.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. My friend, that homosexuality exists in the Sudan for centuries. It's nothing to do with colonialism. In the city, you melt, whether you are lesbian or homosexual. But in the villages, they are known. But you don't talk about them. You don't ostracize them. They are part of the community. Even some of them, as I know, even some of them are married with children. And yet they are homosexual. But in a sense, accepted that this is the case. So there is no question of marginalize those people in any way, economically, politically, or socially. Alcohol, the boza, the aragi, has been for centuries. Even I know people, elderly people, who lost their eyesight. They are blind because of this potent aragi they drink from Baragawi Day. I remember I used to come and see me, there and say, have you got, anything I could drink? Mayat al-Ingiliz, which means whiskey. And I say, well, I do not want to have the reputation of providing alcohol to those people. And it's still the favorite Sudanese drink for the Sudanese is whiskey, right? So, it's again to blame the colonialism for this. It's not correct thing. It's part and parcel of their daily life, those people. But the Sudanese, interesting, are very tolerant. Not the government, but the people. You drink. And I have seen people, they pray, and after they pray, right, bring the whiskey, even among educated Sudanese. I've seen with them, high official civil servant. I sit with them. They pray, and then where is the whiskey? Where is the ice? Where is the water? Right? And they drink like fish. Right. They drink everything. They don't leave things till tomorrow or the after tomorrow. So that is an easy way out of this old colonialism. What about yourself? Look at yourself. That people drink Marisa perfectly all right. And they used to have in dias. I remember I've been to one of these indais just to look, you know, sort of thing. And until it became really problematic under Nimeri, you know, sort of just before Nimeri, closed them up because of violence and sometimes, you know, quarrel and knifing people and so, and rowdiness. This is why they were just thought outside the communities. You know, you don't have indaya within settlement, but on the outskirts of settlement in case of a problem. So these things, again, educated Sudanese, people with particular political orientation, everything is colonialism. That's a part of the British. I mean, that's a, you know, it's not them introducing these. It already exists, except they say, the whiskey, fine. You know, you bring the whiskey and think, but the araki is more potent than the whiskey, particularly a brand of, I never drank that because it's very potent. And I've seen people without, you know, lost their eyesight because they drink daily with that araki because there is no. And then I think the other drink, which I haven't seen, is sherry, which is a kind of wine into it. And that's, you know, sort of you elevate, I remember, financially from araki. If you want to drink something better, sherry. And if you have the money, whiskey. No gin, no vodka, that's later, but whiskey to this very day. The favorite, if I may say, the fairest communist members, the best thing to drink is they sit and drink whiskey. That's what they drink. Even in English pubs, they say, I want whiskey. Not pint of bitter, I think. Right. Thank you very much. Now, I think is the last two questions are very interesting. And one is whether the concept of, you know, Arabism represented into the Ba'athist party in the Sudan, which has really no roots whatsoever in Sudan society or politics, or Islamism. Islam in Sudan, as you know very well, you Iris, I think, this came to Sudan as in the form of Sufism, not what you see now, ISIS and all the forms of Wahhabism and things like that. No. Still, theoretically and on the whole, every Sudanese have a sheikh. And that sheikh is a Sufi sheikh. So only when Hassan al-Turabi came saying, this is all wrong. You know, there is no, it's like the Wahhabis, you know, thinking that, you know, all the Sufis and associated cult are what they call bid'ah. This is a new thing which is not allowed in Islam. This is their own interpretation. But to Africa, south of the Sahara, is they know Sufism. And that's what, you know, say Hassan al-Turabi didn't understand. Or if he did understand, he doesn't want to accept the fact that people's religious belonging is different from his, and therefore he has to respect that rather than marginalize, saying, oh, this is wrong. This is what they say, right and wrong. This is wrong and this is right. And so the question is whether these two trends in Sudan politics, secularism in terms of Arabism, and Sudanese, even Northern Sudanese, say, well, we are partly African, partly Arabs. We are not purely Arab. But those Arabs, whether Egyptian or Syrian or Iraqis, they think that we are all Arabs. They say, no, we are a mix, a perfect one. So there's nothing to do with us, all this. It's only people sitting in Khartoum. What was the man who was the Secretary General of the Ba'athist Party, Malassi, he was a lawyer. He died. But he was supported by Saddam Hussein to popularize Arabism and the Ba'athism. But do you think, both of you, whether, you know, these two ideologies are leading to the disintegration of Sudan as we know it after the separation from the South, whatever remain from Sudan? I mean, now the conflict between Burhan and Hemeti, you know, what are they quarreling about? About religion, about Arabism, or about economics, or about power?
Thank you for that question, which is also a very broad one if we consider, yeah, you know, also historical time. So, well, talking about disintegration or fragmentation implies the notion of a unit called Sudan. So again, I think we should recall that Sudan as a political and territorial entity has been constructed firstly by foreign conquests in the 19th and early 20th centuries. We have talked a little bit about the Turquia and the Anglo-Egyptian condominium. And secondly, also through Sudanese ideologies and state structures such as the Mahdiya, and also this trend of Sudanese nationalism based on Arab and Islamic culture that developed also during colonial times. Yet, as has also already been argued by historians such as Heather Sharkey, the moments when the North, the South, and the West were actually united are quite short in history. So we can already state that since the 16th century, state administrations based in Sinnar, El Fasher, and later Khartoum and Omdurman, more often than not, controlled only part of this territory. One should also bear in mind that during most of the Anglo-Egyptian era, during most of the first half of the 20th century, the North and the South were administrated separately by the British-dominated Sudan government. So actually, if we consider Sudan as a place and as a society, it is really characterized by diversity, as you have also started to say about Islam. So, and I think this is linked to the vastness and the of this territory, and also due to the, to its physical location on the globe. So we have a very high degree of geographical, social, and cultural diversity, which we should maybe recall for people that are not very familiar with Sudan. Let's say about Sunni Islam that there are many different Sufi orders, various then ideological Islamist streams, but also about other religions, about Christianity. There are different churches, Protestant, Catholic churches, and there are also all these various so-called African religions. And in terms of languages also, we have, of course, Arabic, but also Juba Arabic, English, Nubian, Bija, Fur, Zarawa, Masalit, Dinka, Nuer, etc., Shiduk, Barizande. So we have tens or even hundreds of languages. So I say this to emphasize that the idea of a unitarian Sudan is a political concept and the result of forces and actions that have sought to foster unity rather than a given or frozen social reality. And it's clear that since the late colonial era, and especially since 1948, with the advent of the first Sudanese Minister of Education, Abdelrahman Ali Taha, decades of Arabization and Islamization policies have attempted at uniting the country, but they have rather nurtured multiple oppositions in Sudan's peripheries, be it in the south or among Western Muslim groups that do not identify themselves as Arabs. So this politics of cultural homogenization partly explain the civil wars between the successive Khartoum governments and rebel movements such as Anyanya and then the SPLM, and later in Darfur from 2003, the Sudan Liberation Movement and the Justice and Equality Movement, and the eventual secession of South Sudan in 2011. So I think that, yes, this politics of cultural homogenization has a part in fragmenting the country. And this topic has been much discussed by academics since maybe Mudathir Abdelrahim, but also Scopas Pogo, Francis Deng, Amir Idris, Heather Sharkey, myself, and others. And I think that in this book, Ordinary Sudan, there are not many chapters discussing precisely this topic. Maybe only my chapter actually addresses Islamism as a political ideology, perhaps also Abir Noor on the Sudanese General Women's Union, and maybe Lucie Revia on other mass organizations and neighborhood committees organized by the Incas also touches upon the Islamist political ideology. Just a few words on my chapter. I have sought to analyze the teaching of military sciences, Ulum Askariya, as a school subject in Sudanese high schools under the Incas regime, more particularly after the 2005 peace agreement between the North and the South. And I have argued that al-Bashir's government strove to avoid the partitioning of the country by using ideological indoctrination, drawing on an Islamist worldview and on Sudanese patriotism rather than Arab nationalism, also drawing on disciplinary control over bodies. Let us think, for example, about the military type of uniform that all pupils, boys and girls, had to wear in schools, but also about mourning rituals and martial songs that were sung by pupils and that some former pupils called Anashid Jihadiya, so jihadi songs. And there was also this recruitment of teenagers, secondary school students, into the paramilitary forces with compulsory training sessions in the popular defense forces. Mm-hmm. And then the chapter also reflects on narrative forms of violence imbued in this military curriculum. I have shown that the textbooks that I have analyzed narratively tend to dissociate war and violence. And a case in point is the depiction of the 1948 Arab-Israeli war in Palestine. These textbooks praise the role of the army in Sudanese history, mentioning the army as a kind of vector of democracy and silencing, of course, the military coup, the varying military coup in 1958, 1969, 1989. And above all, they silence information on the civil wars in southern Sudan and Darfur. So I have tried to reflect on silence as a form of violence. Maybe silence was perhaps conceived as a means to unite people, but in fact, it rather functioned as a vector of further fragmentation among Sudanese citizens. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very glad you brought the question of violence. To me, communism, socialism came from Egypt during the Mehdi's, the Sudan Socialist Union. Ba'athism came from Iraq and Syria, right? And the only person, sort of thinker to me, well, of course, Wahhabism, but it didn't take any root in the Sudan, Wahhabism. The only thinker in the Sudan is Mahmoud Mohammed Taha. He is an original thinker, Sudanese. He didn't bring this ideology from anywhere else, but he thought that Islam need to be rethought of, re-looked at it. And this is the only way, it's a kind of the only way to help the Sudanese in the future, rather than you have these divisions. He was a Unitarian way, his philosophy, rather than, you know, you are Shafi'i, you are Hanbali, you are this, you are that, you are this. So, and he was sadly hanged as a Sudanese thinker. It's terrible, you know, what Nimeiri did for that man. So, and this is what, you know, say, well, what is the future? Why, at the moment, this Bashir and Himeti, who was part of al-Bashir people, it's not something different, but he's interested in money, he's interested in power, and so is al-Burhan. But Burhan, he was a kind of al-Bashir man, you know. He was, and I think is dividing the Sudan, is fragmenting the Sudan, the Bashir. And so is also the Ba'athist one side, the communists on this side. So there's a lot of all these loyalties are really dividing the nations. And it may be in the long run, say, well, actually, we Darfurian, and in fact, Darfurian, they used to come to Oxford and talk to me at the conferences. They say, we need the United Nations to come to Darfur and take over. And then we will have an election and see whether we want to join the Sudan or leave the Sudan. So maybe in the future, with all these problems, say, well, actually, thank you very much, goodbye. You know, we had enough of your central government. So that kind, it's not a question of ideology, it's a question of ethnicity, that we are Darfurian. It's nothing to do with communism or socialism or Islam. It's Darfurian, it's ethnic. It's like the Southern Sudanese, John Garang, and all Southern Sudanese leaders in the 1950s. So they fought not on communism, except John Garang later, but previously, we are different. We are not Arab, we are not Muslim, we need our independence. And they achieved that through two civil wars. And Darfur is doing the same thing. You know, saying, well, we don't want, you know, to be part, because from 1956, I remember in 1960s, the cabinet, if you look at the cabinet, there's only one from Darfur. Darfur is a huge area. And also in the east, the Bija group and Hadanda, one MP, one minister. Now, this is unfair. If you want to incorporate all the people, then you have a proper, you know, distribution of positions of power. Because of lack of this, people say, well, why should we join the Northern Sudanese? Well, Nasser Bahar, you know, the Nile Valley people, why should we join them? You know, it's better that we fight for our independence and things. So I put that one in, is because it is a problematic, is that how to if you would let, you know, these ideologies seep into the political arena, then you have these problems. You know, you need to look at your people, at the Sudanese, and say, if you want to live together, then you have to come together and share power fairly and squarely, rather than, you know, they don't count, you know, so, you know, they are not important. We have the gold, they don't have the gold. So they begin to assess in terms of financial materials. And the last question, very briefly, both of you, Alina and Iris, is the question of this. Bashir introduced the idea of civilizational project. I mean, I don't know what you think of it. Sudanese lack civilization. The Sudanese have civilization way back, you know, even they say before the ancient Egyptian pharaohs, you know, sort of dynasties. They are cultured, they are civilized, they know how to behave, they know how to eat, they know how to do things, they know how to pray in the way they think they are. So this civilizational means demeaning your own people because you think you know better, and therefore you should civilize them. Now that is absolutely, I mean, you just tell the Northerners, the Shaidi or Jaliyin or Halfa, what the Nubian will say, who are you? You came from Arabia, we are here. We have civilization which runs back into thousands of years. So again, these concepts being brought in under al-Bashir by educated people who have interest personally. I'm sure many of you, you know, you go to Sudanese, you are invited to lunch, you are to dinner, you are invited to wedding. And look at that, is a fluorescence of culture, of attitude, of even in language itself, which I'm surviving. And I remember I collected quite a lot of poetry by women in the North. Women. Really, I mean, it is beautiful poetry with the men. So when you say civilization, you and Bashir, you have no idea what's happening outside your, you know, the presidential palace, because you don't go and visit. And things like, I remember I was with one minister once being driven in Khartoum, and he came to the Souq al-Farangi, you know, the foreign market, and all this, which I'm sure you have seen, all this rubbish pile up front. I said, Minister, you talk about civilizational. You talk about, you know, Islam is good. And look at the rubbish. Where is al-Bashir? Does he come and see this? See, so you've got reality versus these ideas we will make you a better person. We'll make the country as a better, you know, country with this, which is not the case. They're all entered corrupt, I'm afraid. Yeah. So do you have any reflection on the last point, Iris and Elena?
I will start and then leave the word to Iris. In fact, again, I think I agree very much with this general description that as in all the book, our point of view is the one of the actors. And what we try very, very, very hard throughout the whole book is to underline their agency. And so for this, it is difficult for us to accept a word like indoctrination, in the sense that for us, people are responsible for what they do. Of course, they have enormous structural constraint. Of course, the situation doesn't leave them much choices in many cases to do what they would to decide. But in reality, they do their best out of the situation they have. And so they have to cope with that. They have to make choices, and they do make choices the best possible way they can. So this is something, for example, you can read in the article by Lucie Revilla about the Ingaz, to show that, of course, you have, you know, the Ingaz and the structure of Ingaz, but then you have the creation of this intermediary class, in factually, by people that, as you say, clung to the Islamist regime on a daily basis. You know, they didn't really have the choice. They did it, and they made the best out of it in order to use it for their own personal trajectories, you know. So, in fact, they, on the one side, they are connected to the Islamist regime, which shape this class, but at the same time, they are not just subaltern or passively receiving what they get. They make out of it something and they use it for their own life. And so there is perhaps you can call it a strategy, but in a way they are actors in what is happening. This is our take. And in the other way, of course, because many people say in relation to colonialism, for example, yes, colonialism came and then imposed on people ideas like nationalism or modernization. And this is also something that we reject, in the sense that, again, that people had some idea and they made the best out of it. And again, for me, the trade union or the article about the dames by Barbara Crashari show very well that ideas that were brought by colonialism, they were completely turned inside down to make people empower themselves through, you know, action of demonstration and, you know, organization, trade union movements. And so, again, you might have ideas that circulate, but people always appropriate and react the best possible way they can.
Thank you. Iris, do you have any?
Yeah, just very shortly.
Contribution.
I agree on this last important point. I think that in the book, most of the chapters bring out people's agency, but also tensions within various groups, institutions, and communities, as well as local appropriations, reformulations, or even rejections of dominant discourses. There are ambiguities, there are tensions, and that's what is interesting also in Sudanese history. And I will just end with an example from my case study. I have interviewed a few former pupils also to have their to hear their experience about schooling, you know, under the Ingaz regime. And some people told me that showed me that the implementation of the military curriculum varied according to places and teachers, and in particularly according to the political affiliation of teachers, if they were closer or less closer to the Islamist regime. And also that the pupils didn't always comply with official requirements. For example, rather than singing a religious song, some girls would reply with what they termed a scientific song, or they even unplugged the music recorder so that the jihadi song would not be heard. So there were also some small acts of daily resistance or opposition to this kind of attempt by the regime to impose this overall social, moral, and I would say even this special order. So yeah, I think that's all for now.
Yeah, well, thank you very much indeed, both of you. Thank you, Iris and Elena, for a very fruitful discussion of the book, and we enlarge on the book, on some of the themes of the book, which is really very interesting. And I hope now, if the audience have anything, do you have any audience who want to ask question? Iris?
No, we don't have at the time audience, so we will just come to the conclusion.
To the conclusion, which is that I'm very glad that this book has been published, The Ordinary Sudanese, From Social History to Politics from Below, which was published by Duke Riter in 2023, which I think should be an important reference work for all the people who are interested in politics, economic, feminism, the institution of the state, and one aspect of it, which I very, very important to me, is the question of the agriculture pump schemes in northern Sudan, which the British introduced, five of them, and still they are the backbone of the economy of northern Sudan. It's quite interesting work, though I disagree with the classification which I said about aristocracy. This doesn't exist. Or elites, another word, even Sudanese, educated Sudanese, refer to themselves as the elite. Well, I think it's, in the West, we have a different perception of what elite is and how do you classify people as elite. But there is very common occurrence, this elite, the elite of Sudan, and both men and women. Anyhow, but that's there's a lot of discussion. So please, do consult this book, and preferably to buy this book to help further research and further publication. And we thank, on your behalf, the audience, we thank both Elena as well as Iris for their tremendous work in preparing this book for publication, and is a wonderful contribution to Sudan in the present circumstances of Sudan, very sad circumstances. And our heart and thought goes to ordinary, now I use your word, ordinary Sudanese, who suffered and suffering from all sorts of things due to the follies of the army and rapid support force, fighting each other and hurting the civilian, hurting their possession, and all sorts of, I have some friends there who really, their story is terrible, what happened, and they don't deserve it. And I think, as I said, this book will remain for some years to come as the only contribution, because I can't see anybody going to Sudan to do research or be able to do research except from the outside on newspaper and things, but to see Sudanese, to sit with them or travel and talk to them, and getting information or a statistic will be out of the question in the present circumstances. So we thank you very much for this book, and we wish you both, Iris and Elena, for further publication. I look forward to reading any further publication. And I look forward to receiving the copy in due course. But anyway, for the PDF.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ahmed Ashani, for preparing also and leading this discussion.
Pleasure to you. Yes. Thank you for the dialogue with me.
Thank you for you for your thought-provoking question and your reflection. We also learned from your discussion, so it was very, very precious to us. Thank you very much.
And thank you, and have a good day, the rest of the day. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.